This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 12th of February, these are our main stories. The paramilitary rapid support forces in Sudan are reported to have stormed the country's largest displacement camp, which houses 500,000 people who fled fighting. The United Nations says it believes 1,400 people were killed during last year's anti-government protests in Bangladesh, mostly by the security forces. And pressure is growing on the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to clarify his latest Gaza ceasefire demands as the truce edges closer to collapse. Also in this podcast,
between 20 and 60% of our nurses responding reported symptoms of anxiety or reported that they had depression or symptoms of depression.
A snapshot of the mental health burden on nurses around the world. Zamzam Camp in North Darfur houses 500,000 people who have fled violence in Sudan and who were already facing famine. It's been the target of shelling since late last year. Now refugees there say the RSF paramilitary group has stormed it. There's been looting and a market set ablaze. Our correspondent in Nairobi, Barbara Plet-Usher, has been following the story.
In terms of the casualties, it's really hard to get a clear picture. We don't really have information about numbers or, you know, injuries or deaths. What we have heard is that the injured are having a hard time getting treatment because the hospital in Zamzam no longer does surgeries. And the North Darfur health minister has also said that people who were injured weren't able to get to the nearby city of Al-Fashir. If you remember, that's the city that's under siege by the RSF. He says the RSF is blocking the road. Although hospitals in Al-Fashir have also either been shut down or damaged in the long siege. In terms of damage in the camp, it seems as if there was quite extensive damage to the market. That's what we're told. And there are also videos on social media which show smoldering ruins, which we are working at the moment at getting verified.
And we know that the people who were living there are already in a terrible situation. Why is the camp a target for the RSF?
Well, an RSF spokesman I contacted actually denied that the fighters had penetrated the camp. He said they had seized a military base near the camp, which belongs to a group called the Joint Forces. This is an armed group that fights alongside the Sudanese military. And he said it had been shelling RSF checkpoints for days. An eyewitness told us that the Joint Forces had confronted the RSF in the camp, but he said they arrived after the attack to respond to it.
And looking at the conflict, which has been going on for some time now, are we reaching a decisive point?
We might be, broadly speaking. The army has made some significant gains in central Sudan recently. It recaptured the key city of Wad Medani, and it has gained control of Jazeera State, which is a strategic state. And now it's closing in on Khartoum from the south and has already reclaimed some regions of the capital city from the RSF, in particular Khartoum Behri, and it's advancing to the center of the city. It's not clear how much resistance they'll face, whether they'll get street-to-street fighting or whether there will still be prolonged battles or whether they will have a victory soon.
There really is nowhere else for the people who are currently in Zamzam to go, is there?
Not really, no. I mean, you know, before the war, there were about 100,000, 200,000, it's not entirely clear, but people in Zamzam who had been displaced by previous conflicts in Darfur. And the number has really swelled since the civil war. And so you've even had people from Al-Fashir coming to Zamzam because the fighting there is so intense. So if they're going to be displaced again, and according to reports, there was an exodus of quite a large number of people because of the fighting, it's not clear where they can go.
Barbara Plet-Usher in Nairobi. A BBC investigation has revealed allegations that British oil giant Shell ignored repeated warnings that a $1 billion clean-up operation of polluted land in southern Nigeria has been beset with problems and corruption. The claims come as a trial begins this week at the High Court in London between two Nigerian communities and Shell over its pollution of the region ahead of the sale of its assets in the West African country. This report from our correspondent Simi Jolawosho in Ogoniland in the Niger Delta.
It's been seven decades since oil was discovered in southern Nigeria. Now, formerly fertile landscapes appear as toxic wasteland. The family of 50-year-old mother of six, Paulina Abe Pepe, survived on fishing for generations until a decade ago.
The place was greener, not only mangroves, but all by the shoreline. There were popo trees, palm trees and more. But during the spills, the destruction has polluted everywhere. During the spill, most of the children have gotten diseases from drinking the water, and many have died. I've lost 8 kids. My husband is sick. I think it's because of the pollution in the environment.
It's the reality of many here.
Literally smells like petrol. And this is the water that you're expected to use to drink, cook, wash. It smells like we're in the fuel station. I guess that's why it's even foaming up.
37-year-old Grace Audi lives in Ogale with her partner and 2-year-old. Oil spills have contaminated the only borehole they have access to, meaning they must buy clean water for 4,500 naira or $3 a day. The average wage here is less than 8.
So do you have to be careful how much water you use?
Yes.
In 2011, the UN found people were drinking water contaminated with a known carcinogen at levels over 900 times above an international guideline. It led to the formation of a new cleanup agency called HyPrep, run by the Nigerian government and part-funded by oil companies, including Shell. The project was to take 30 years to complete. Now, the BBC can reveal the $1 billion cleanup operation has been beset with allegations of collusion and fraud. A whistleblower who worked on the scheme and whose identity we're protecting because they fear reprisals told us the operation is a con to siphon money and was widely known by the government and Shell to be failing.
It's common knowledge that really what we're doing is a scam. Most of it is to fool the Ogoni people.
The BBC has seen internal documents suggesting representatives of Shell and of the Nigerian government were warned over years of alleged failings at the agency, including the awarding of contracts to incompetent companies and even of falsified test results.
Getting away with this scam starts with issuing contracts to contractors who have absolutely no interest or experience in remediation. Then you enter into the world of a high degree of collusion between the government agencies, the regulators and the contractors.
In a meeting with the British High Commissioner to Nigeria last year, minutes of which have been obtained under freedom of information laws, Shell representatives acknowledged the institutional challenges of the cleanup agency and the chance of the refusal of future funding towards it. When we asked Shell whether it knew of alleged failings at HyPrep, the company told us, HyPrep is an agency established and overseen by the federal government of Nigeria, with its governing council largely made up of senior ministers and government officials, along with 5 representatives of communities and NGOs and a single Shell representative. The BBC also visited areas where the Nigerian government and Shell have repeated claims have been cleaned up. It did not take long for us to see oil seep from the ground and float on the water.
Wow, that's the black.
Shell told the BBC the operating environment in the Niger Delta remains challenging because of the huge scale of illegal activities such as oil theft. We take extensive steps to prevent this activity and the spills it causes. When spills do happen from our facilities, we clean up and remediate regardless of the cause. If it's an operational spill, we also compensate people and communities. The BBC has asked HyPrep and the Nigerian government to comment on the allegations, but has received no response. This week, 2 Nigerian communities will bring a case against Shell at a London High Court. The company is selling its onshore facilities in Nigeria, but questions over its conduct and legacy here remain.
Simi Jalawasho in the Niger Delta. UN human rights investigators say they believe 1,400 people were killed during last year's anti-government protests in Bangladesh, mostly by the security forces. The protests began as a student-led movement against public sector job quotas, but soon morphed into a nationwide uprising that forced the then Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to resign and flee to India. Now, the UN says the deadly violence against protesters could amount to crimes against humanity. Our South Asia editor is Ambarasa Natarajan.
According to this UN investigation, many of these violence were targeted and they were all carried out with the knowledge, coordination and direction of those in power and the security officials, basically to maim people, and they were also alleged to have given directions to kill and enforce disappearances. And many of these incidents happened. And they went to Bangladesh soon after the government of Sheikh Hasina fell. And they spoke to more than 230 people, spoke to weapons expert and the victims and the families of those who were killed in this violence in Bangladesh. Now, how this happened? As you mentioned, it all started as a student protest. Then it became a widespread anti-government movement with various political parties and religious groups joining this student protest. And as a result, Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, on the 5th of August, she fled to India in a helicopter after this mass uprising. And then now an interim government headed by the Nobel laureate Mohammed Yunus is in charge. And they asked for this investigation to find out, because we saw the television pictures of police firing into the crowd, and then there were clashes between the protesters and the security forces. And now the UN says that it could amount to crimes against humanity, and then calling for criminal investigation.
Yeah, I think the report says three quarters of those who were killed were victims of shooting by military rifles, including shotguns with pellets. But one of Sheikh Hasina's former ministers dismissing it all as preposterous allegations.
I messaged him and he responded by saying that these allegations were preposterous and no security official was given the order to shoot at civilians straight away into the protesters. In fact, he said Mohammed Ali Arafat, he was a minister at that time, he said he was very much involved in the meetings regarding the July protests. At any of these meetings, he was never aware of giving them direction to the security forces to stop these protesters, disperse them at any cost. But then the UN report suggests otherwise, and it also talks about the supporters of the then governing Awami League also targeting these protesters. And we spoke to several doctors at the time in hospitals where many bodies were brought, and then hundreds of injured civilians were brought. And there was a popular uprising against the government at that time. Now, what this UN report gives is a legal standing, some document by an external agency which has gone into these allegations of human rights abuses, now has come out with a fact-finding report. And that gives a chance for the government to use this for criminal investigation and also to launch legal proceedings. But at the moment, she is in India, she is in exile, and it all depends on whether Delhi wants to extradite her back to Bangladesh to face these criminal charges.
Anbarasan Etirajan speaking to Ben Brown. There's mounting pressure for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to clarify his latest Gaza ceasefire demands as the fragile truce edges closer to collapse. After a long Israeli Security Cabinet meeting yesterday, Mr. Netanyahu appeared to back President Trump's suggestion that Israel cancels the ceasefire deal altogether unless the hostages were returned by Saturday. Hamas has issued a statement renewing its commitment to the ceasefire and accusing Israel of jeopardising it. Our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell gave us her assessment of Mr. Netanyahu's comments.
The Prime Minister is someone who always chooses his words very carefully. He came out with this video statement after the Security Cabinet met for 4 hours. He said they had reached a unanimous decision. And he said, if Hamas doesn't return our hostages by noon on Saturday, the ceasefire will stop. He stopped short of specifying all our hostages, exactly echoing the language of President Trump when he had proposed this kind of threat. That could mean then potentially all 76 of the remaining hostages, or it could mean what he said, just the three who were originally scheduled to be released before Hamas said that it was freezing the releases of the hostages because of ceasefire violations by Israel, which of course Israel has denied. So we then had these different briefings, key ministers who came out across the Israeli media last night and on social media, and they said that the Security Cabinet meant the demand was for all hostages. But you've got some Israeli analysts saying, crucially, this morning that he has deliberately, the Prime Minister, not closed the door on the deal.
And the IDF, meanwhile, is saying that it has raised its level of readiness. What does that mean?
So what we understand is that the Israeli military has begun to mobilise reserve units, it's deployed reinforcements both inside Gaza and close to the border to be prepared to go back on the offensive if the ceasefire with Hamas collapses. And they're saying that they could get back onto a fighting foot very quickly. The situation now is very different from that before the beginning of the war, because, of course, the Israeli military still does have troops deployed along the Philadelphia corridor, the strategic strip of land between Gaza and Egypt, and all around the perimeter inside the Gaza Strip. At the moment, they're supposed to be on defensive missions, but they're saying they can easily be put on the offensive instead.
Now, the next stage of the ceasefire was always going to be difficult. Where does the ceasefire stand right now, and what is being done behind the scenes to try and keep it on track?
I would say that overall, the ceasefire really is in its most delicate moment since it was first implemented 3 weeks ago. You can guarantee that Arab countries, that the mediators, Qatar and Egypt in particular, are behind the scenes putting a lot of pressure on Hamas to try to kind of get things back on track. Egypt, meanwhile, has confirmed that it has this kind of comprehensive vision for reconstruction of Gaza. There is also, we can see from the Arab states, a kind of more concerted effort now to put up a sort of united front. They're promising to have a summit later this month to formulate their own plans for Gaza that will not require the removal of the entire Gaza population, some 2 million people, in the way that President Trump has been outlining with his plan.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. In Australia, two nurses who appeared in a video apparently threatening to refuse to treat and even to kill Israeli patients have been suspended by the health authorities. The video was posted on TikTok and has attracted widespread political condemnation. Police in the state of New South Wales say they are aware of the incident. The federal health minister, Mark Butler, said the views expressed were completely unacceptable.
It is the obligation of every single health professional to treat and care for whomever comes before you. The idea that you would single out a particular group in our community and indicate you wouldn't care for them runs against every single principle in our healthcare system.
Our correspondent in Sydney is Phil Mercer.
This appears to have been recorded in a hospital. The video was shared on TikTok by a content creator called Max Viefer, who says he's from Israel. Now, in the footage, another man who claims to be a doctor tells Mr. Viefer that he sends Israelis to an Islamic place akin to hell. Now, this man goes on to make a throat-slitting gesture. A woman then comes on the screen and says that she won't care for Israelis in the hospital. I won't treat them. I will kill them, she says. And as you'd imagine, this video has generated immense outrage and fear here in Australia and beyond.
So what do we know about the people who are in this video and what's happened to them?
Well, the police here in Australia say that they have identified the two nurses involved in the video. They have been suspended. Now, state authorities here in New South Wales say that these two nurses are under investigation and will never work in the Australian health system again. The Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said that this video was disgusting and vile.
So apart from the political reaction, what other sorts of reaction has there been?
Well, this all comes as Australia has recently passed tougher laws against hate crimes following a wave of high-profile anti-Semitic attacks here in Australia in recent weeks and months. We have heard from the head of the Executive Council of Australian Jury, a man called Alex Rivchin, and he's given his reaction to seeing this video.
This morning we saw a video that eloquently illustrated the evil of anti-Semitism and the extent to which it has consumed the minds of some Australians. The video that we saw was absolutely chilling and horrific. The brazen way, the open and confident manner in which these people spoke about killing and torturing and wishing death upon Israelis, and particularly coming from our medical professionals who we look to for care and support, was a ghastly thing to see.
The views there of Alex Rivchin, who is a senior member of the Jewish community here in Australia. In recent months, in incidents unconnected to this hospital video, there have been a series of arson and graffiti attacks involving homes, cars and synagogues in Jewish areas across Australia. Worth noting, too, that community groups have said that there has been a sharp rise in Islamophobic attacks as well here in Australia in recent months, too.
That was Phil Mercer. Still to come.
Whilst authorities were wrangling for years over the project plan, the beavers did what beavers do, building a dam of their own.
The beavers who rescued a long-stalled conservation project. The Ukrainian president has given a wide-ranging interview to the British Guardian newspaper, in which, for the first time, he's spoken of a possible land exchange with Russia in the event of negotiations to end the war. Volodymyr Zelensky said parts of Russia's Kursk region, which have been held by Ukrainian troops for the last 6 months, could be swapped for territory in Ukraine currently occupied by Russia. The Russians, well, they don't seem keen on the idea. It was described as nonsense by Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev, a close ally of Vladimir Putin. Later in the week, Mr. Zelensky will meet the US Vice President J.D. Vance and attempt to secure America's continued military support. Kurt Volker was Donald Trump's United States Special Representative for Ukraine during his first term. He told the BBC why the president wants an end to the fighting there.
First off, I think this is one of Trump's top priorities. I think he has made it very clear he wants to end the carnage, end the fighting, stop the war. The second is that he has told the American people we shouldn't be spending American taxpayer money on the war in Ukraine. And now there are various ideas on the table about how to support Ukraine, how to end the war, but not have it cost the American taxpayer.
So what to make of the interview? James Waterhouse is in Kyiv.
We're in a transactional phase, shall we say, of Russia's full-scale invasion. In the past, it was about President Zelensky pleading for what he saw as being right, you know, helping a democratic country, a sovereign nation, stand up against a larger aggressor. Now he is having to sell the commercial benefits. It's as simple as that, really, it seems, for America to continue supporting it. So he'd always said this surprise attack into Russia's Kursk region wasn't about long-term occupation. The hundreds of square kilometres they've seized are a relative sliver compared with what Russia has taken the other way. But now, for the first time, he's being clearer. He's saying, we're going to use this as political leverage for a potential peace negotiation. If Russia wants what we've taken back, you'll have to give back what you currently occupy inside Ukraine, because there is also an operational reality here in that his forces have been unable to shift Russian troops or even hold them back in many parts of the front line in the east. So I think this is what President Zelensky is shifting himself towards now. He's gearing up, as you said, for the Munich Security Conference, where he is meeting a US vice president who's been extremely critical of American support for Ukraine. The White House has its eyes on Ukraine's natural resources. It wants to invest in them as a kind of return on the billions it's given. And so this is this kind of transactional tone we are starting to see from Ukraine's leader.
And even this tentative suggestion of land swaps, the Russians have already suggested that they're not interested. We've heard from Dmitry Medvedev. He says it's nonsense. Is there some sort of middle ground possibility?
That may well materialise down the line. At the moment, the Kremlin is just repeating its demands, really, these really quite extreme demands of complete control of the four Ukrainian territories it occupies territory in. That would involve Ukraine surrendering entire cities that have yet to fall. And it wants the complete demilitarisation of Ukraine, and it's repeated that false claim that Ukraine is run by a Nazi government. So Russia is standing firm, but if you look at the language from Washington, it's looking to appease Moscow already. We're already seeing the conversation shift to Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, and President Zelensky is just fighting to keep himself in that conversation, because what he's said time and time again is that there can be no talks about Ukraine without Ukraine, but that's materialising.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. A study of 9,000 nurses in 35 countries has found the profession faces an unprecedented challenge through public violence and aggression towards nurses, and also high rates of anxiety and depression. Professor Alison Squires of the Rory Mayers College of Nursing in the US led the study.
What we were aiming to do was to actually document the scope of nurses' mental health and see how it was similar and also different across different countries. So my research consortium, we were able to take the early data from our ongoing study and actually start taking a look at where we were seeing similarities and differences, but also seeing the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and showing how really it didn't matter where you were. If you were a nurse, the pandemic was having a significant impact on your mental health.
And so what was the state of that mental health did you find?
Well, we were finding about an average of, it was quite a wide range of between 20 and 60% of our nurses responding reported symptoms of anxiety or reported that they had depression or symptoms of depression. And so, you know, the average overall was running about somewhere around about 30%. So slightly higher than what's typically seen for most general mental health statistics in a population.
And were there any countries that stood out for you that were worse off before or that had gotten worse or some which were doing better?
Well, what's interesting is for a lot of the countries involved in this particular study, they had no baseline mental health statistics of their nurses. So this was one of the first studies to really, as far as we can tell, for many of the low and middle income countries to actually capture sort of a baseline idea of how are nurses doing and what is the state of their mental health. And it did strike me particularly that nurses in Mongolia reported particularly high rates of both anxiety and depression overall compared to most of the other countries. But we also noticed that for some other countries that many people said, no, I don't have anxiety, I don't have depression, but I have a lot of the symptoms. So there's also a stigma that is coming through in our data where nurses may not feel comfortable reporting or naming that they have anxiety or depression, but they're more comfortable sharing that, well, yeah, I have a lot of the symptoms that go with anxiety and depression.
We know that some of the countries that you are looking into, you just mentioned Mongolia, some of them will not be rich countries. They will not have enough resources. So what is the support system there to help those who've come or who've told you that there is a they have anxiety, that they're a bit depressed?
Well, one of the things that we saw was nurses tended to turn toward either their coworkers or their family and friends first. And that was their primary source of support. And so in and that was true regardless of whether it was high income countries or low income countries. So that, your inner circle is the first place that people start when they're looking for support. But the question is when it gets beyond what just your friends, your family members, maybe even for those who comfort in religious support from a clergy person, then, what happens, though, when you get beyond that need? And that's where we need to figure out things like what happens when, if you do need that support. One of my consortium members, they hadn't completed the study yet, but they shared that that USAID had actually been doing rapid response training in mental health for health workers in Malawi due to the recent events in the U.S. and the stopping of USAID programming, that those efforts have been stopped at the moment. So, there was examples out there of being able to do some rapid intervention and provide support in low-income settings, but the legacy and how sustainable that will be now is under question.
Professor Alison Squires, and she was speaking to Victoria Awonghunda. Here in the UK, the government has toughened up its immigration rules, making it almost impossible for people who arrive in the UK via illegal routes or methods to become a British citizen. The move has been condemned by charities and some MPs. Rob Watson, our political correspondent, is following the story.
It is a big change, Jackie, but in a funny sort of way, it represents a toughening after a softening on the previous government, let me explain. So the last Conservative government had introduced what many thought was pretty draconian measures in 2023, which they thought might violate UN conventions on refugees, essentially saying if you came to the UK in a small boat, no matter how good your claim was, no matter how deserving you were for refugee, for asylum status, you would not be considered because you had arrived here, as the government thought, illegally. The new Labour government has repealed that, but it's toughening things by saying, look, even if you've got asylum status, even if you've been considered, yes, you're a legitimate refugee, in most cases, you will normally refuse the next step of being considered for citizenship if you came here illegally.
And what sort of reaction has there been?
Well, I guess you could divide it into two, Jackie. There's those more to the left or on the sort of human rights, civil rights side who would say this was terrible. So, for example, you've got several Labour MPs saying this is crazy because, you know, it would turn refugees into second-class citizens. You've got the Refugee Council saying that's a group that, if you like, promotes the rights of refugees, says that just doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, if people have come here, surely you'd want them to be full participants in society and give them citizenship if they've earned it. On the other side, on the right, if you like, you've got the Conservative Party, the former governing party, and Reform, the sort of populist party of the right, saying you should not, the Labour government should not have softened the rules in the first place about considering people arriving in small boats. So, if you like, the new Labour government finds itself caught from both sides.
That was Rob Watson. In the Czech Republic, an important conservation project has been completed south of Prague. It had been held up for several years and was expected to cost about $1 million. But while the humans wrangled over the details, a family of beavers stepped in and completed the job themselves. David Lewis has been following the story.
Beavers are known for gnawing wood, felling trees and getting dams done. And now the can-do creature can add contributing to the coffers to its peculiar portfolio. Czech officials had been planning a dam, built by humans it should be added, to protect endangered crayfish in the Klubava River from acidic water spilling over from two nearby ponds. But the ever-ready rodents, well, they had other ideas. Whilst authorities were wrangling for years over the project plans at the former army site, the beavers did what beavers do, building a dam of their own. The active animals thus created a wetland with pools and canals. The area is now roughly twice larger than previously planned. The beaver family then moved onto a gully encircling the ponds, and they haven't finished there yet. They've built at least four dams in that gully and are still working on more. Beavers create these pools of water to protect themselves against predators and to hold their food during the winter. Environmentalists claim there were discussions about building dams there with water companies. Now the estimated saving is 30 million Czech koruna. That's $1.2 million. Bohumil Pfizer from the Czech Nature Conservation Agency can scarcely contain his delight. It's full service. Beavers are absolutely fantastic, and when they're in an area, they can't cause damage, he insisted to the AFP news agency. They do a brilliant job.
And that was David Lewis. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this one or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at BBC World Service or use the hashtag Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Gareth Jones. The producer was Ed Horton. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.